Yes, Major League Baseball is back. Season is kicking off in South Korea. We'll have to wait a little longer to see the Mariners back in action. But let's get a Mariners, or I guess I should say a Seattle Pilots history lesson from our own resident historian. Here's Felix Spinell.
Go, go, ye pilots. God, they went. They did.
That's 86-year-old Bill Shonley. He and Jimmy Dudley were the broadcast team for the Seattle Pilots, the Major League Baseball club that played here for just one season back in 1969.
Now it's the third inning in a nothing-to-nothing ball game, and you're now to bring you the action is Bill Shonley. Bill?
All right, Jimmy, thank you very much. For California, the top three of the order once again, Alomar, Spencer, and Jim Fregosi.
Shonley grew up outside of Philadelphia, hearing legendary baseball voices like Mel Allen, Red Barber, and Bill Stern. He dreamed of one day being a big league broadcaster himself. He came to Seattle in the 1950s and broadcast a lot of local sports. Then came the chance of a lifetime.
The city finally got a hold of a Major League Baseball franchise. And as a relatively young man in those days, I got to be a Major League Baseball broadcaster with the Seattle Pilots. And I thought at that time, my goodness, I always enjoyed baseball and doing the broadcast. I might be in baseball for the rest of my life, but it only lasted that little over 1 year.
The Pilots played just one solitary losing season here. Then they went bankrupt and left town.
So the people, the Major League folks from the American League all got together and decided to take the franchise away. Seattle, God bless them at the time, tried their darndest to keep that franchise right where it was, because Seattle, the Northwest, they were the major leagues as far as baseball were concerned. Well, it did not work out. There are a lot of things going on behind the scenes, but that's the basic story. So that the Seattle Pilots then became the Milwaukee Brewers.
There were plenty of backroom and front office shenanigans that sent the Pilots on their way. But since voters in 1968 had approved the kingdom based on having a team, a lawsuit against Major League Baseball got the Mariners in 1977. But all that was in the future. In 1969, the Pilots played at Six Stadium along Rainier Avenue, where a Lowe's home improvement store now stands. Six was built back in the 1930s for the Seattle Rainiers of the Pacific Coast League. Shonley says it had its own unique charm.
Well, how do you describe it in this day and age? It was nothing in those days, let's put it that way. The field itself, the playing surface, was manicured to the nth degree. Everything was fine, but had no seats to speak of. You know, there were no suites, no anything. We had 100 hot dog stands, I guess, you know, and soda stands and things like that. It was old school.
The characters were old school, too, including Pilots manager Joe Schultz.
Schultz and I knew one another. He used to turn around and said, "Shines, Bud's going to taste good tonight." One of the few times that the Pilots would win the game. And he had some great phrases, which I can't repeat right now, but he was just a great human being.
When the Pilots went to Wisconsin, Shonley could have gone with them. Instead, he decided to stay in the Northwest. Opportunity came knocking almost immediately.
Harry Glickman, who put together the Portland Trailblazers, he found out that I was available. You know, he called me and he said, "How would you like to do NBA basketball?" Well, I had done everything else in the world, but I wasn't too much involved in the NBA in those times. And I said, "Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal." I came down to Portland and we talked and we shook hands. And that was 46 years ago. I'm still with the Blazer organization.
Bill Shonley spent the rest of his career with the Trailblazers, including that team's 1977 NBA World Championship. But he still thinks about baseball and what might have been and what could still be.
Just a shame that the Pilots and the city of Seattle couldn't put that situation together in those years. But the Mariners are there, and they've had quite a run. I hope they have a great year this year.
Let's all lift a cold one in memory of the Pilots and Schulte and hope it's gonna taste good for Mariners fans on plenty of nights this season. I'm Felix Bonnell for Cairo Radio.
In the fourth inning for the Pilots, Wayne Comer, Steve Hoadley, and Danny Walden. And the Pilots are still looking for that first base hit off the right-hander, Andy Messenger.
Our resident historian Felix Bonnell, Bill Shonley, passed away last year at the age of 93. The Mariners are preparing for the season. Opening day is next week. In their latest spring training game yesterday, the Mariners thumped the Colorado Rockies 12-3. A fire station in Mount Vernon just cannot catch a break. Here's Cairo News Radio's Diane Duthweiler with the saga.
Lake McMurray's fire station suffered more damage when it caught fire early yesterday. That, after burst pipes in January, led to extra repair work when construction crews found asbestos in Firehouse 15. Repairs aren't even finished. Now it appears an arsonist set a temporary portable toilet on fire. Fire Chief Stuart Kranick.
We're thankful we didn't lose the entire building, but it's certainly a substantial amount of damage.
Kranick says members of his all-volunteer team were first to arrive at their burning building.
And they were able to pull our vehicles out of the station, fortunately, so our vehicles weren't destroyed in the fire.
That means Lake McMurray's fire crews can still respond to emergencies, even though last month, one of their fire trucks was unexpectedly pulled from service.
We determined that it wasn't cost-effective to repair it due to the scope of what it would take to bring that truck back into safe operating range.
Darrington's fire department is giving them a surplus truck, but yesterday, homesick in bed, Kranick told me
that fire truck was actually ready to be picked up today, but we're going to leave it up in Darrington for a little bit longer because we don't have a station to put it into yet.
Kranick says the fire destroyed the station office. They lost their computer, all their files, and some expensive training programs. They also lost progress on station upgrades so it can be used as a Red Cross shelter.
So we were working on putting in an emergency backup generator, and we added a larger propane tank that we could have a place that, you know, has the heat on, that has water and supplies and things for the community. This is just another thing that hurts us in that quest.
Also lost, prizes donated for the fishing derby the station still hopes to sponsor next month.
And all that stuff has been destroyed. So I don't know if we'll be able to do the fishing derby.
Also in jeopardy, Fire Station 15's annual salmon feed.
I'm hoping that we'll still be able to do that event. We certainly would be sad to lose our main fundraiser for the year, especially at a time when we really could use it the most.
Chief Kranick is a volunteer with a family and a full-time job in tech. He says just like the burst pipes, his team of 20 will have to fight fires and deal with their insurance company and then replacement and rebuilding from the fire.
I'm not sure if I'm laughing or crying at this point.
Wow, and you think you're having a bad day. That puts things in perspective, doesn't it? Lake McMurray District 15 is accepting donations of time and money to help rebuild. In the meantime, Chief Kranick says if his fire crews have any trouble responding to emergencies, there are two neighboring districts on standby to help out. Let's take you now to the state of Texas, where there's always something interesting and even somewhat confusing going on. Yesterday, we heard that the Supreme Court had suspended enforcement of the state's new immigration law, where state officers could just stop people they suspected of not being here legally. And then the law was reinstated briefly, and then I wake up this morning to find out that, no, it was unreinstated briefly, so I can't think of anybody better to iron all this out than Chris Fox, who covers Texas for CBS News from Austin. So can you explain what has happened in the past 24 hours, Chris?
Yes, I can use a term that we're now using. It is judicial whiplash. And that's the term that basically we're facing. Yeah, yesterday, at this time yesterday, we were still under the Supreme Court rule that it had blocked Senate Bill 4 from going into effect until indefinitely. And the thought was until a full hearing in the Fifth Circuit Court, which was scheduled for April. Then by noonish locally, the Supreme Court voting 6-3 to say basically, hey, this is a Fifth Circuit Court problem, not ours. Let's let them deal with it. And then asking them to do that expeditiously. And then they did. They quickly announced hours later that they were going to hold a hearing this morning, which is set to start just right now on the matter. And then by 10 o'clock locally, 10 o'clock p.m., the three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit Court went back to undo what they originally did, and that was to block the law from going into to keep it straight, to keep the law from going into effect. Now, back in late February, U.S. District Judge David Ezra in Austin ruled on this, saying blocking the law from going into effect initially. And he said, quote, it threatens the fundamental notion that the United States must regulate immigration with one voice. It was the state of Texas that appealing to the Fifth Circuit Court who blocked that lower court stay, allowing the law to go into effect. The Supreme Court jumped in three times, blocking it from going into effect until the Fifth Circuit then again blocked it again. So, yeah, basically judicial whiplash. So the one nice thing about that, everybody gets to celebrate a little bit.
Yeah, I guess so. So how long was it actually in effect?
About 10 hours.
10 hours. So were there any interceptions of migrants by state officers during those 10 hours?
No, it was mostly confusion from sheriffs and police chiefs. Messages from various sheriffs along the Rio Grande Valley saying they didn't really understand how this works, what they were supposed to be doing. Local police hadn't been trained on this, and it's something that came up when the bill was rolled out on the state house floor, and amendments were proposed to set aside money that would give immigration law training to local police. And all those amendments were rejected. The idea being at that point, it was so late in the special session, they wanted to keep the bill clean, and that would have added a couple more days onto it. There's still a great deal of question. Fort Worth Police Chief is catching flack. He released a statement yesterday saying, we're not going to do anything different. El Paso Mayor Oscar Leeser with an interesting comment saying that while we'll follow state law, we're short-staffed. Our priorities are keeping El Paso safe, and immigration is not our top priority. So there's been a lot of pushback. The law was written so vaguely that it left that wide open. No arrests were made in the 10 hours. It's also written in a way that if the police believe someone illegally crossed, Governor Abbott, when he signed it into law in Eagle Pass, Texas, made a comment saying if they see them crossing the river, they can arrest them. Well, how does that work with police who are not on the border? And can they credibly, and that was part of the arguments made by the U.S. Department of Justice and the ACLU of Texas, who have teamed up in their lawsuit trying to strike down the law and saying that it would invite racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is interesting. The state has countered. What's interesting is everyone's arguments have remained the same, yet the courts have changed their opinions multiple times. And the state is saying, lawyers for Texas, saying that the state has a right to defend its own borders under the invasion clause of the Constitution. Judge David Ezra didn't think that this was an invasion. So that's why he rejected their argument. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the courts, because eventually it's all headed right back to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, Chris, you live there. Do you feel insecure? I mean, in your daily life, do you see waves of strangers crossing the border and, I don't know, camping in doorways or whatever?
No. And strangely enough, a report came out a couple weeks ago that some of the safest cities and towns in Texas are along the border. And kind of dispelling that argument. But there has been a lot of rhetoric the other way that this is an invasion by cartels and they're bringing in fentanyl. And a lot of that argument, though, can be made. Fentanyl is coming in from ports of entry and not necessarily people carrying it across the Rio Grande. So there's a whole lot of misinformation out there about how bad this is. Now, it is difficult for towns like El Paso, where I spent a great deal of time, because the asylum process takes so long, months, if not maybe years, and these asylum seekers are stuck there. And I had a chance to interview the Sacred Heart pastor who runs Sacred Heart Church in El Paso, which is one of the largest that takes in the migrants. And he was saying that the one thing he would ask President Biden when he was visiting El Paso last year for is more judges to move this process along, because these people are stuck here until they can get some sort of resolution in the courts. So, and that's another argument about Senate Bill 4. Do we have enough judges to deal with it? Do we have enough prison space to deal with it? Are there enough police officers? And so there's so many questions. The bill was written rather vaguely and somewhat on purpose. It was meant to get the issue about whether states should have rights regarding immigration and defending its own borders before the U.S. Supreme Court. And some actually argued that that was more important to the authors of the bill than actually getting the law passed.
CBS correspondent Chris Fox in Austin, Texas. Thank you, Chris.
I hope I made some sense out of it.
You absolutely did. And we appreciate your help, too.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. We're going to hear how a teenage cancer survivor and a DJ are bringing smiles to Children's Hospital in Minnesota. CBS's Derek James caught up with them.
See, let's get something from our area. How about a little Naughty by Nature, huh?
Oh, yeah, here we go.
There you go, there you go. Yeah, right on the snare drum.
His booking agent for this gig is 13-year-old cancer survivor Braxton Battaglia.
He puts like the songs together and it sounds so good.
And her nonprofit, TB1 Fund.
My main goal is always to just help brighten the days of patients and families in the hospital. Because like I said, I've gone through it before and I know how hard it is.
The Music Man and his family have connections here, too.
Our firstborn, Flora, was born very early as a preemie, and so we were here for about 4 weeks and just, you know, just really loved and fell in love with the hospital and all the programs and services that they offer here.
Before his mom passed away, she made blankets for the patients here.
I'll never forget the day we came in here with all these boxes and dropped them off, and I see that they still use them to this day.
It's all part of what drives DJ Mad Mardigan to bump up the BPMs and the spirits of the kids battling life-threatening diseases. His beats are moving patients.
We had a patient that didn't want to leave their room the entire admission, and then this show started, and we said, come on down to the dance party, and they said, Mom, I want to go. So they got out of bed, they came on down, they joined into the dance party, and that was their first motivation to get out of bed. When you're just sitting in a room, it gets, like I said, super boring and can be scary. So when you turn it on and see something that's like going on that's super fun, that's like a really cool thing to see.
And I heard you re-signed him to coming here for another year. Is that true?
Yep.
I really think it's the best children's hospital in the world.
That is Derek James reporting from CBS Minnesota.
Time for G. Scott from the Gian Ursula Show. And this is sad. The United States is no longer in the top 20 when it comes to happiest people.
That's weird.
What's going? And apparently, it's the young people that are whining about it.
Whining.
Yeah. Because we're always comparing ourselves to others, and the United States has had this thing called, not that the world has had it too, but social media has made us get online, so you can have a great job, great spouse, good kids, everything's great in your life. Better than you ever expected. But you get on good old Facebook and you see someone who shows their highlights of their life while you're living the reality of yours. Mm-hmm. And their highlights are fantastic and phenomenal. And now you say, I want that. Instead of 2 trips a year, I want 4 trips a year. Instead of living in a 3,500 square foot home, I want to live in a 5,000 square foot home. Instead of having a nice, whatever type of car you like, mm-hmm. you saw this car, this brand new, you want that. We have a keeping up with the Joneses problem. We have a comparison problem. And a lot of times we aren't happy, and social media has really pointed a spotlight on that.
But people realize that a Facebook life is only a dolled up version of that person's life.
No. Well, you know what? Let me get personal for a second. Yes. In 2009, it's probably one of the biggest things that led to my depression. It's one of the biggest things that led to my downfall in a lot of areas in my life. I didn't know when social media first came out and you would see other people post on social media. We didn't know that. I didn't know that that's your highlights of your life. Now, we know that now because we've been doing it. But there was a point in time that you got on social media and you looked at people. You're like, oh, how's Jimmy doing? Oh, what? Jimmy's on vacations all the time. You see, he just got newly married. He just got a new car, new house. Oh, my God. Jimmy's doing well. Meanwhile, you don't know that Jimmy behind the scenes is struggling. And so you are comparing the reality of your life to the highlights of others. So no, Dave, I struggle with that for a second.
Same thing happens, you know, just in reality, too, in the workplace. We have no idea unless, you know, we're pretty intimate in the newsroom just because that's how newsrooms are.
Yeah.
So we get to know each other a little better. But you present your best self at work, right? You dress right. The same. You take a shower. You don't know that, you know, somebody's struggling in their relationship or dealing with depression or just lost a loved one unless they say so. The problem is with social media is that there's no nuance to it. So whereas we don't really get to know our coworkers that well and we think, oh, you're just doing fine. Body language, we can pick up on that.
No doubt.
You can't pick up on body language on social media.
No doubt.
You might be able to hear it in their tone of voice. You can't do that on social media. So that's sort of where the divide
is. How is this new, though? I mean, our family photo album didn't include pictures of the kids crying. It was only the happy stuff. When Dad was taking his, you know, 16mm movies, We staged, you know, little plays and things that showed everybody having a good time.
But you looked at those photos in the context.
By the time I left my birthday party in tears, they didn't put that on tape, yeah. Right? So
look at those photos in the context of reality, though. Yeah. Those photos exist within our relationships for face-to-face, person-to-person. On social media, there is no reality. There is only what you want people to see.
I can answer that easily. You have Colleen right here, you have Sully right here, and Nick right here. You work with them every single day, mm-hmm. right? How many times have they been in your house and looked at your photo albums?
Never.
Yeah. That's what's different. Today, everybody is seeing each other's photo albums. Only mm-hmm. thing is, nobody's putting pictures of them baby pictures when you're naked. That used to get me. Everybody used to,
oh, yeah.
Man, why did parents used to put the naked?
Oh, because their buns are so cute. They're little biscuits. Are you kidding me?
Why did they do that?
I want to remember the biscuits.
But did my dad really have to show the diaper picture to my girlfriend when
Absolutely.
I was 16?
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Those kind of things. But, yeah, it's... I totally understand what's going on. And also, another reason why we are falling behind when the friend problem is this. How often have you not talked to a friend of yours on the phone in some time, but because you see them post, you feel like you know how they're doing? Yeah. So we are talking to each other less. We are calling our friends less because, we know Dave's fine. Yeah, I saw him on Facebook. He posted the other day he was going out to the opera. He's good. But when's the last time you called Dave? So we're not even talking to each other more. So I'm not trying to blame social media for everything, but it's a problem.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is why America's no longer in the top 20 of happy countries.
Sad.
And that's Mickey time. The new Beyonce album is out. The cover art has been released. It's called Cowboy Carter. Have you seen this album cover?
I have. The album drops on March 29th, actually.
She's riding backwards side saddle on a mm-hmm. white horse with a cowboy hat, a red, white, and blue tight-fitting suit, and an American flag waving in the breeze with the yellow fringe around it.
Yeah.
And yet she says, this ain't a country album.
She says it's a Beyonce album, Dave. There's a difference. It's a Beyonce album.
An artist would say that.
Right.
So bring me up to speed on this whole alleged controversy over whether she's allowed to sing country music or not.
Well, she is from Texas. I believe she was born in... I want to say maybe her dad was born in Alabama. Her mom and she were born in Texas. Yeah. And so...
Louisiana. Yeah. I'm trying to sing the lyrics because
exactly.
She says where her parents are born in one of her songs.
Alabama, Louisiana, but yeah. I believe she was born in Houston, Texas. That's where Destiny's Child got its mm-hmm. start. One of my good friends actually tried out for Destiny's Child, which is
what?
So funny. Katrina, yeah. Katrina Pendleton. At any rate, and I remember she grew up doing the rodeo country scene, you know, performing during the rodeos with Destiny's Child. So country music is in her blood. So it's not out of nowhere. She's always been a country music fan.
You're a Southern gal, though. Can you tell? Yeah. And I got into mm-hmm. country, you know, it's like when in Rome, when I moved to Spokane for 5 years, you have to be into country when you live in Spokane. And I got into it, right? Like I can get down with country now.
Mm-hmm.
But what are the requirements to do country? Because remember, Taylor Swift was a country artist. She decided to do pop and had to like say goodbye to the country music industry. They bid her adieu. I don't understand that.
I don't understand it either, because when I worked in country music, we played her songs that crossed over into the pop realm. So I don't think there's any requirement. You just have to have that twang, that style. And being that she's from Texas, she grew up in Houston, she's got it in her soul, I guess. And she's a Southerner. She is a true Southerner.
So do you have to be born in the South to do country?
music?
Nah, because
you
I
gotta
mean,
sound Southern to do country music.
I mean, you don't have to.
You got to play certain instruments.
We're dancing around it. Do you have to be white to sing country music?
Oh, I wasn't dancing around it. I'm actually trying to figure out, is there a requirement to be considered country because it is such an exclusive club?
I'm sure if you were to ask the country music artists, they would probably tell you, well, it's kind of in your soul. You're either born with it or you're born into it. I mean, there were black artists back into the 1800s who performed country music to Fort Bailey. And then in the 1900s, you've got Charlie Pride. There's even Darius Rucker. I know Darius. He's such an honest,
sweet
guy.
Yeah, from Hootie and the Blowfish.
Yeah, and then he crossed over. I got to hang out with him on tour a couple of times. And I mean, and I did ask him, so what's it like to be black and play in the country music realm that is predominantly a white person genre of music? And he said, it's great. It's amazing. You'd be surprised how much love I'm getting. I don't understand the Beyonce backlash, other than the fact that maybe she's just a strong woman who has such strong opinions.
Aren't all country artists who are women strong?
Yeah.
This is very true, but it may be that it's you know, it could be the color of her skin. Now, most of her big backlash did come from 2016 at the Country Music Awards when she performed a song called Daddy Lessons with Chicks.
Yeah.
Fans loved it, but it drew backlash. It drew big backlash.
Well, because the Dixie Chicks have a complicated history, too. Remember when they did the whole Not My President thing and the country music? They kicked the Dixie Chicks to the side for a while, too.
It's been so far from that moment, right? But the Chicks they're still a little controversial.
Well, that's right. They're just called the Chicks now because Dixie is racist. Okay, got it.
Right. Well, according to them, they wanted to get rid of it, right? So, you know, Cowboy Carter is the second installment of a three-part project. The first one was Renaissance, which came out in 2022. And now she's got Cowboy Carter, which is coming out on the 29th. And then she'll have another album. So she's just going through her Renaissance era, if you will. She wants to do country, she can do country. She wants to do hip hop, she can do hip hop. Next thing you know, she'll do love song ballads. I don't know, but it's Beyonce. And Beyonce can do whatever Beyonce wants.
She says, y'all haters corny with that Illuminati stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll say stuff. Yeah.
There you go.
So she's not going to listen to the haters, Dave.
That's good. Yeah. I just think it's quaint that artists are still releasing album covers, even though there are no albums anymore.
Mm. Well, no. Vinyls are making a hot comeback.
That's what I was going to say.
Is Beyonce on vinyl?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I did not know that.
And the cover art that comes with it and all, it's a huge industry.
So there are only a couple of artists out there right now that actually release CDs. Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift is one of them.
Cassettes, too.
Yeah, Madonna is the other. Cassettes. And Beyonce.
Cassettes?
Cassette tapes.
They're making a comeback with the Walkmans. Good. My daughter actually went on Amazon and said, how much is a Walkman? And I went, are you kidding me, child? Why do you want a Walkman?
Oh, I'm glad I saved all my old analog equipment.
There you go. But yes.
You could just open your garage and, make a ton of money.
Yeah. Dave, I would pay money to walk in your garage.
Mm, well,
that could be your retirement. You're not invited. I'm not invited. No.
Thank you, Mickey.
You're welcome.
It is 8:54 real-time traffic from the Beacon Plumbing Traffic Desk. Here's Chris.
That's okay. I laid out in the sun yesterday listening to ELO. So there you go.
Who?
Electric Light Orchestra.
Electric Light Orchestra.
Oh, that's right.
It was a nice, relaxing day going back to the late 70s.
That's why you have that glow about you.
Yeah. I avoid the controversy altogether.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.